Training for Greatness, Glimpses of Abraham Lincoln's Boyhood. In pronouncing a eulogy on Henry Clay, Lincoln said, "His example teaches us that one can scarcely be so poor but that, if he will, he can acquire sufficient education to get through the world respectably." Endowed as he was with all the qualities that make a man truly great, Lincoln's own life teaches above all other things the lesson he drew from that of Henry Clay. Is there in all the length and breadth of the United States today a boy so poor as to envy Abraham Lincoln the chances of his boyhood? The story of his life has been told so often that nothing new can be said about him. Yet every fresh reading of the story fills the reader anew with wonder and admiration at what was accomplished by the poor backwoods boy. Let your mind separate itself from all the marvels of the 20th century. Think of a time when railroads and telegraph wires, telephones, great ocean steamers, lighting by gas and electricity, daily newspapers, except in a few centers, great circulating libraries, and the hundreds of conveniences which are necessities to the people of today were unknown. Even the very rich at the beginning of the 19th century could not buy the advantages that are free to the poorest boy at the beginning of the 20th century. When Lincoln was a boy, thorns were used for pins. Cork covered with cloth or bits of bone served as buttons. Crusts of rye bread were used by the poor as substitutes for coffee, and dried leaves of certain herbs for tea. Abraham Lincoln was born on February 12, 1809, in a log cabin in Hardin County, now LaRue County, Kentucky. His father, Thomas Lincoln, was not remarkable either for thrift or industry. He was tall, well-built, and muscular, expert with his rifle, and a noted hunter, but he did not possess the qualities necessary to make a successful pioneer farmer. The character of the mother of Abraham may best be gathered from his own words. "All that I am or hope to be," he said when President of the United States, "I owe to my angel mother. Blessings on her memory." It was at her knee he learned his first lessons from the Bible. With his sister Sarah, a girl 2 years his senior, he listened with wonder and delight to the Bible stories, fairy tales, and legends with which the gentle mother entertained and instructed them when the labors of the day were done. When Abraham was about 4 years old, the family moved from the farm on Nolan Creek to another about 15 miles distant. There the first great event in his life took place. He went to school. Primitive as was the log cabin schoolhouse, and elementary as were the acquirements of his first schoolmaster, it was a wonderful experience for the boy, and one that he never forgot. In 1816, Thomas Lincoln again decided to make a change. He was enticed by stories that came to him from Indiana to try his fortunes there. So once more the little family pulled up stakes and moved on to the place selected by the father in Spencer County, about 1.5 miles from Gentryville. It was a long, toilsome journey through the forest, from the old home in Kentucky to the new one in Indiana. In some places they had to clear their way through the tangled thickets as they journeyed along. The stock of provisions they carried with them was supplemented by game snared or shot in the forest, and fish caught in the river. These they cooked over the wood fire, kindled by means of tinder and flint. The interlaced branches of trees in the sky made the roof of their bedchamber by night, and pine twigs their bed. When the travelers arrived at their destination, there was no time for rest after their journey. Some sort of shelter had to be provided at once for their accommodation. They hastily put up a half-faced camp, a sort of rude tent with an opening on one side. The framework of the tent was of upright posts, crossed by thin slabs cut from the trees they felled. The open side, or entrance, was covered with pelts, or half-dressed skins of wild animals. There was no ruder dwelling in the wilds of Indiana, and no poorer family among the settlers than the new adventurers from Kentucky. They were reduced to the most primitive makeshifts in order to eke out a living. There was no lack of food, however, for the woods were full of game of all kinds, both feathered and furred, and the streams and rivers abounded with fish. but the home lacked everything in the way of comfort or convenience. Abraham, who was then in his 8th year, has been described as a tall, ungainly, fast-growing, long-legged lad, clad in the garb of the frontier. This consisted of a shirt of linsey woolsey, a coarse homespun material made of linen and wool, a pair of homemade moccasins, deerskin leggings or breeches, and a hunting shirt of the same material. This costume was completed by a coonskin cap, the tail of the animal being left to hang down the wearer's back as an ornament. This sturdy lad, who was born to a life of unremitting toil, was already doing a man's work. From the time he was 4 years old, away back on the Kentucky farm, he had contributed his share to the family labors, picking berries, dropping seeds, and doing other simple tasks suited to his strength. He had thus early begun his apprenticeship to toil. In putting up the half-faced camp, he was his father's principal helper. Afterward, when they built a more substantial cabin to take the place of the camp, he learned to handle an axe, a maul, and a wedge. He helped to fell trees, fashion logs, split rails, and do other important work in building the one-room cabin, which was to be the permanent home of the family. He assisted also in making the rough tables and chairs and the one rude bedstead or bed frame, which constituted the principal furniture of the cabin. In his childhood, Abraham did not enjoy the luxury of sleeping on a bedstead. His bed was simply a heap of dry leaves, which occupied a corner of the loft over the cabin. He climbed to it every night by a stepladder, or rather a number of pegs driven into the wall. Rough and poor and full of hardship as his life was, Lincoln was by no means a sad or unhappy boy. On the contrary, he was full of fun and boyish pranks. His life in the open air, the vigorous exercise of every muscle which necessity forced upon him, the tonic of the forests which he breathed from his infancy, his interest in every living and growing thing about him, all helped to make him unusually strong, healthy, buoyant, and rich in animal spirits. The first great sorrow of his life came to him in the death of his dearly loved mother in 1818. The boy mourned for her as few children mourn even for the most loving parent. Day after day he went from the home made desolate by her death to weep on her grave under the nearby trees. There were no churches in the Indiana wilderness, and the visits of wandering ministers of religion to the scattered settlements were few and far between. Little Abraham was grieved that no funeral service had been held over his dead mother. He felt that it was in some sense a lack of respect to her. He thought a great deal about the matter, and finally wrote a letter to a minister named Elkins, whom the family had known in Kentucky. Several months after the receipt of the letter, Parson Elkins came to Indiana. On the Sabbath morning after his arrival, in the presence of friends who had come long distances to assist, he read the funeral service over the grave of Mrs. Lincoln. He also spoke in touching words of the tender Christian mother who lay buried there. His simple service greatly comforted the heart of the lonely boy. Some time after, Thomas Lincoln brought a new mother to his children from Kentucky. This was Mrs. Sally Bush Johnston, a young widow who had been a girlhood friend of Nancy Hanks. She had 3 children, John, Sarah, and Matilda Johnston, who accompanied her to Indiana. The second Mrs. Lincoln brought a stock of household goods and furniture with her from Kentucky, and with the help of these made so many improvements in the rude log cabin that her stepchildren regarded her as a sort of magician or wonder worker. She was a good mother to them, intelligent, kind, and loving. He was 10 years old at this time and had been to school but little. Indeed, he says himself that he only went to school by littles, and that all his schooling did not amount to more than a year. But he had learned to read when he was a mere baby at his mother's knee, and to a boy who loved knowledge as he did, this furnished the key to a broad education. His love of reading amounted to a passion. The books he had access to when a boy were very few, but they were good ones, and he knew them literally from cover to cover. They were the Bible, Robinson Crusoe, Pilgrim's Progress, A History of the United States, and Weems' Life of Washington. Some of these were borrowed, among them the Life of Washington, of which Abraham afterward became the happy owner. The story of how he became its owner has been often told. The book had been loaned to him by a neighbor, a well-to-do farmer named Crawford. After reading from it late into the night by the light of pine knots, Abraham carried it to his bedroom in the loft. He placed it in a crack between the logs over his bed of dry leaves, so that he could reach to it as soon as the first streaks of dawn penetrated through the chinks in the log cabin. Unfortunately, it rained heavily during the night, and when he took down the precious volume in the morning, he found it badly damaged, all soddened and stained by the rain. He was much distressed, and hurried to the owner of the book as soon as possible to explain the mishap. "I'm real sorry, Mr. Crawford," he said, in concluding his explanation, "and want to fix it up with you somehow, if you can tell me anyway, for I ain't got the money to pay for it with." "Well," said Mr. Crawford, "being as it's you, Abe, I won't be hard on you. Come over and shuck corn 3 days, and the book is yours." The boy was delighted with the result of what at first had seemed a great misfortune. Verily, his sorrow was turned into joy. "What? Shuck corn only 3 days and become owner of the book that told all about his greatest hero? What an unexpected piece of good fortune." Lincoln's reading had revealed to him a world beyond his home in the wilderness. Slowly it dawned upon him that one day he might find his place in that great world, and he resolved to prepare himself with all his might for whatever the future might hold. "I don't intend to delve, grub, shuck corn, split rails, and the like always," he told Mrs. Crawford after he had finished reading The Life of Washington. "I'm going to fit myself for a profession." "Why, what do you want to be now?" asked Mrs. Crawford in surprise. "Oh, I'll be president," said the boy with a smile. "You'd make a pretty president with all your tricks and jokes, now wouldn't you?" said Mrs. Crawford. "Oh, I'll study and get ready," was the reply, "and then maybe the chance will come." If the life of George Washington, who had all the advantages of culture and training that his time afforded, was an inspiration to Lincoln, the poor, hard-working backwoods boy, what should the life of Lincoln be to boys of today? Here is a further glimpse of the way in which he prepared himself to be President of the United States. The quotation is from Ida M. Tarbell's Life of Lincoln. "Every lull in his daily labor he used for reading, rarely going to his work without a book. When plowing or cultivating the rough fields of Spencer County, he found frequently a half hour for reading. For at the end of every long row, the horse was allowed to rest, and Lincoln had his book out and was perched on stump or fence almost as soon as the plow had come to a standstill." One of the few people left in Gentryville who still remembers Lincoln, Captain John Lamar, tells to this day of riding to mill with his father and seeing, as they drove along, a boy sitting on the top rail of an old-fashioned stake-and-rider worm fence, reading so intently that he did not notice their approach. His father, turning to him, said, "John, look at that boy yonder, and mark my words, he will make a smart man out of himself. I may not see it, but you'll see if my words don't come true." That boy was Abraham Lincoln, adds Mr. Lamar impressively. Lincoln's father was illiterate and had no sympathy with his son's efforts to educate himself. Fortunately for him, however, his stepmother helped and encouraged him in every way possible. Shortly before her death, she said to a biographer of Lincoln, "I induced my husband to permit Abe to read and study at home, as well as at school. At first he was not easily reconciled to it, but finally he too seemed willing to encourage him to a certain extent. Abe was a dutiful son to me always, and we took particular care when he was reading not to disturb him, would let him read on and on till he quit of his own accord." Lincoln fully appreciated his stepmother's sympathy and love for him, and returned them in equal measure. It added greatly to his enjoyment of his reading and studies to have someone to whom he could talk about them, and in afterlife he always gratefully remembered what his second mother did for him in those early days of toil and effort. If there was a book to be borrowed anywhere in his neighborhood, he was sure to hear about it and borrow it if possible. He said himself that he read through every book he had ever heard of in that county for a circuit of 50 miles. And how he read! Boys who have books and magazines and papers in abundance in their homes, besides having thousands of volumes to choose from in great city libraries, can have no idea of what a book meant to this boy in the wilderness. He devoured every one that came into his hands, as a man famishing from hunger devours a crust of bread. He read and reread it until he had made the contents his own. From everything he read, says Miss Tarbell, he made long extracts with his turkey buzzard pen and briar root ink. When he had no paper, he would write on a board and thus preserve his selections until he secured a copybook. The wooden fire shovel was his usual slate, and on its back he ciphered with a charred stick, shaving it off when it had become too grimy for use. The logs and boards in his vicinity he covered with his figures and quotations. By night he read and worked as long as there was light, and he kept a book in the crack of the logs in his loft to have it at hand at peep of day. When acting as ferryman on the Ohio in his 19th year, anxious, no doubt, to get through the books of the house where he boarded before he left the place, he read every night until midnight. His stepmother said he read everything he could lay his hands on, and when he came across a passage that struck him, he would write it down on boards if he had no paper, and keep it by him until he could get paper. Then he would copy it, look at it, commit it to memory, and repeat it. His thoroughness in mastering everything he undertook to study was a habit acquired in childhood. How he acquired this habit, he tells himself. Among my earliest recollections, I remember how, when a mere child, he says, I used to get irritated when anybody talked to me in a way I could not understand. I do not think I ever got angry at anything else in my life, but that always disturbed my temper and has ever since. I can remember going to my little bedroom after hearing the neighbors talk of an evening with my father and spending no small part of the night walking up and down and trying to make out what was the exact meaning of some of their, to me, dark sayings. I could not sleep, although I tried to, when I got on such a hunt for an idea, until I caught it. And when I thought I had got it, I was not satisfied until I had repeated it over and over, until I had put it in language plain enough, as I thought, for any boy I knew to comprehend. This was a kind of passion with me, and it has stuck by me, for I am never easy now when I am handling a thought till I have bounded it north and bounded it south and bounded it east and bounded it west. With all his hard study, reading, and thinking, Lincoln was not a bookworm, nor a dull companion to the humble, unschooled people among whom his youth was spent. On the contrary, although he was looked up to as one whose acquirements in book learning had raised him far above everyone in his neighborhood, he was the most popular youth in all the country round. No husking bee or house raising or merrymaking of any kind was complete if Abraham was not present. He was witty, ready of speech, a good storyteller, and had stored his memory with a fund of humorous anecdotes which he always used to good purpose and with great effect. He had committed to memory and could recite all the poetry in the various school readers used at that time in the log cabin schoolhouse. He could make rhymes himself and even make impromptu speeches that excited the admiration of his hearers. He was the best wrestler, jumper, runner, and the strongest of all his young companions. Even when a mere youth, he could lift as much as 3 full-grown men. And if you heard him felling trees in a clearing, said his cousin Dennis Hanks, you would say there was 3 men at work by the way the trees fell. His axe would flash and bite into a sugar tree or sycamore, and down it would come. His kindness and tenderness of heart were as great as his strength and agility. He loved all God's creatures, and cruelty to any of them always aroused his indignation. Only once did he ever attempt to kill any of the game in the woods, which the family considered necessary for their subsistence. He refers to this occasion in an autobiography written by him in the third person in the year 1860. A few days before the completion of his eighth year, he says, in the absence of his father, a flock of wild turkeys approached the new log cabin, and Abraham, with a rifle gun standing inside, shot through a crack and killed one of them. He has never since pulled the trigger on any larger game. Any suffering thing, whether it was animal, man, woman, or child, was sure of his sympathy and aid. Although he never touched intoxicating drinks himself, he pitied those who lost manhood by their use. One night on his way home from a husking bee or house raising, he found an unfortunate man lying on the roadside, overcome with drink. If the man were allowed to remain there, he would freeze to death. Lincoln raised him from the ground and carried him a long distance to the nearest house, where he remained with him during the night. The man was his firm friend ever after. Women admired him for his courtesy and rough gallantry, as well as for his strength and kindness of heart, and he in his turn reverenced women as every noble, strong man does. This big, bony, tall, awkward young fellow, who at 18 measured 6'4", was as ready to care for a baby in the absence of his mother as he was to tell a good story or to fell a tree. Was it any wonder that he was popular with all kinds of people? His stepmother says of him, "Abe was a good boy, and I can say what scarcely one woman, a mother, can say in 1,000. Abe never gave me a cross word or look, and never refused in fact or appearance to do anything I requested him. I never gave him a cross word in all my life. His mind and mine, what little I had, seemed to run together. He was here after he was elected president. He was a dutiful son to me always. I think he loved me truly. I had a son, John, who was raised with Abe. Both were good boys, but I must say, both now being dead, that Abe was the best boy I ever saw or expect to see. Wherever he went or whatever he did, he studied men and things and gathered knowledge as much by observation as from books and whatever newspapers or other publications he could get hold of. He used to go regularly to the leading store in Gentryville to read a Louisville paper taken by the proprietor of the store, Mr. Jones. He discussed its contents and exchanged views with the farmers who made the store their place of meeting. His love of oratory was great. When the courts were in session in Boonville, a town 15 miles distant from his home, whenever he could spare a day, he used to walk there in the morning and back at night to hear the lawyers argue cases and make speeches. By this time, Abraham himself could make an impromptu speech on any subject with which he was at all familiar, good enough to win the applause of the Indiana farmers. So his boyhood days, rough, hard-working days, but not devoid of fun and recreation, passed. Abraham did not love work any more than other country boys of his age, but he never shirked his tasks. Whether it was plowing, splitting rails, felling trees, doing chores, reaping, threshing, or any of the multitude of things to be done on a farm, the work was always well done. Sometimes, to make a diversion, when he was working as a hired hand, he would stop to tell some of his funny stories or to make a stump speech before his fellow workers, who would all crowd round him to listen. But he would more than make up for the time thus spent by the increased energy with which he afterwards worked. Doubtless, the other laborers, too, were refreshed and stimulated to greater effort by the recreation he afforded them and the inspiration of his example. Thomas Lincoln had learned carpentry and cabinet making in his youth and taught the rudiments of these trades to his son, so that in addition to his skill and efficiency in all the work that falls to the lot of a pioneer backwoods farmer, Abraham added the accomplishment of being a fairly good carpenter. He worked at these trades with his father whenever the opportunity offered. When he was not working for his family, He was hired out to the neighboring farmers. His highest wage was 25 cents a day, which he always handed over to his father. Lincoln got his first glimpse of the world beyond Indiana when he worked for several months as a ferryman and boatman on the Ohio River at Anderson Creek. He saw the steamers and vessels of all kinds sailing up and down the Ohio, laden with produce and merchandise, on their way to and from western and southern towns. He came in contact with different kinds of people from different states, and thus his views of the world and its people became a little more extended, and his longing to be somebody and to do something worthwhile in the world waxed stronger daily. His work as a ferryman showed him that there were other ways of making a little money than by hiring out to the neighbors at 25 cents a day. He resolved to take some of the farm produce to New Orleans and sell it there. This project led to the unexpected earning of a dollar, which added strength to his purpose to prepare himself to take the part of a man in the world outside of Indiana. Let him tell in his own words, as he related the story to Mr. Seward years afterward, how he earned the dollar. "Seward," he said, "did you ever hear how I earned my first dollar?" "No," said Mr. Seward. "Well," replied he, "I was about 18 years of age and belonged, as you know, to what they call down south the scrubs, people who do not own land, and slaves are nobodies there. But we had succeeded in raising, chiefly by my labor, sufficient produce, as I thought, to justify me in taking it down the river to sell. After much persuasion, I had got the consent of my mother to go, and had constructed a flatboat large enough to take the few barrels of things we had gathered to New Orleans. A steamer was going down the river. We have, you know, no wharves on the western streams, and the custom was, if passengers were at any of the landings, they were to go out in a boat, the steamer stopping and taking them on board. I was contemplating my new boat and wondering whether I could make it stronger or improve it in any part, when two men with trunks came down to the shore in carriages and, looking at the different boats, singled out mine and asked, 'Who owns this?' I answered modestly, 'I do.' 'Will you,' said one of them, 'take us and our trunks to the steamer?' 'Certainly,' said I. I was very glad to have the chance of earning something, and supposed that each of them would give me a couple of bits. The trunks were put in my boat, the passengers seated themselves on them, and I sculled them out to the steamer. They got on board, and I lifted the trunks and put them on the deck. The steamer was about to put on steam again when I called out, 'You have forgotten to pay me!' Each of them took from his pocket a silver half dollar and threw it on the bottom of my boat. I could scarcely believe my eyes as I picked up the money. You may think it was a very little thing, and in these days it seems to me like a trifle, but it was the most important incident in my life. I could scarcely credit that I, the poor boy, had earned a dollar in less than a day, that by honest work I had earned a dollar. I was a more hopeful and thoughtful boy from that time. In March 1828, Lincoln was employed by one of the leading men of Gentryville to take a load of produce down the Mississippi River to New Orleans. For this service, he was paid $8 a month and his rations. This visit to New Orleans was a great event in his life. It showed him the life of a busy cosmopolitan city, which was a perfect wonderland to him. Everything he saw aroused his astonishment and interest, and served to educate him for the larger life on which he was to enter later. The next important event in the history of the Lincoln family was their removal from Indiana to Illinois in 1830. The farm in Indiana had not prospered as they hoped it would, hence the removal to new ground in Illinois. Abraham drove the team of oxen which carried their household goods from the old home to their new abiding place near Decatur in Macon County, Illinois. Driving over the muddy, ill-made roads with a heavily laden team was hard and slow work, and the journey occupied a fortnight. When they arrived at their destination, Lincoln again helped to build a log cabin for the family home. With his stepbrother, he also, as he said himself, made sufficient of rails to fence 10 acres of ground and raised a crop of sown corn upon it the same year. In that same year, 1830, he reached his majority. It was time for him to be about his own business. He had worked patiently and cheerfully since he was able to hold an axe in his hands for his own and his family's maintenance. They could now get along without him, and he felt that the time had come for him to develop himself for larger duties. He left the log cabin penniless, without even a good suit of clothes. The first work he did when he became his own master was to supply this latter deficiency. For a certain Mrs. Miller, he split 400 rails for every yard of brown jeans, dyed with white walnut bark necessary to make a pair of trousers. For nearly a year, he continued to work as a rail splitter and farmhand. Then he was hired by a Mr. Denton Offutt to take a flatboat loaded with goods from Sangamon Town to New Orleans. So well pleased was Mr. Offutt with the way in which Lincoln executed his commission that on his return he engaged him to take charge of a mill and store at New Salem. There, as in every other place in which he had resided, he became the popular favorite. His kindness of heart, his good humor, his skill as a storyteller, his strength, his courtesy, manliness, and honesty were such as to win all hearts. He would allow no man to use profane language before women. A boorish fellow who insisted on doing so in the store on one occasion, in spite of Lincoln's protests, found this out to his cost. Lincoln had politely requested him not to use such language before ladies, but the man persisted in doing so. When the woman left the store, he became violently angry and began to abuse Lincoln. He wanted to pick a quarrel with him. Seeing this, Lincoln said, "Well, if you must be whipped, I suppose I may as well whip you as any other man," and taking the man out of the store, he gave him a well-merited chastisement. Strange to say, he became Lincoln's friend after this and remained so to the end of his life. His scrupulous honesty won for him in the New Salem community the title of Honest Abe, a title which is still affectionately applied to him. On one occasion, having by mistake overcharged a customer 6¼ cents, he walked 3 miles after the store was closed in order to restore the customer's money. At another time, in weighing tea for a woman, he used a 1/4 pound instead of a 1/2 pound weight. When he went to use the scales again, he discovered his mistake and promptly walked a long distance to deliver the remainder of the tea. Lincoln's determination to improve himself continued to be the leading object of his life. He said once to his fellow clerk in the store, "I have talked with great men, and I do not see how they differ from others." His observation had taught him that the great difference in men's positions was not due so much to one having more talents or being more highly gifted than another, but rather to the way in which one cultivated his talent or talents and another neglected his. Up to this time he had not made a study of grammar, but he realized that if he were to speak in public, he must learn to speak grammatically. He had no grammar and did not know where to get one. In this dilemma, he consulted the schoolmaster of New Salem, who told him where and from whom he could borrow a copy of Kirkham's Grammar. The place named was 6 miles from New Salem, but that was nothing to a youth so hungry for an education as Lincoln. He immediately started for the residence of the fortunate people who owned a copy of Kirkham's Grammar. The book was loaned to him without hesitation. In a short time, its contents were mastered, the student studying at night by the light of shavings burned in the village cooper's shop. "Well," said Lincoln to Green, his fellow clerk, when he had turned over the last page of the grammar, "if that's what they call a science, I think I'll go at another." The conquering of one thing after another, the thorough mastery of whatever he undertook to do, made the next thing easier of accomplishment than it would otherwise have been. In order to practice debating, he used to walk 7 or 8 miles to debating clubs. No labor or trouble seemed too great to him if, by it, he could increase his knowledge or add to his acquirements. No matter how hard or exhausting his work, whether it was rail splitting, plowing, lumbering, boating, or storekeeping, he studied and read every spare minute, and often until late at night. But this sketch has already exceeded the limits of Lincoln's boyhood, for he had reached his 22nd year while in the store in New Salem. How he was made captain of a company raised to fight against the Indians, how he kept store for himself, learned surveying, was elected a member of the Illinois legislature, studied law, and was admitted to the bar in Springfield, and how he finally became president of the United States. All this belongs to a later chapter of his life. Lincoln's rise from the poorest of log cabins to the White House, to be president of the greatest republic in the world, is one of the most inspiring stories in American biography. Yet he was not a genius, unless a determination to make the most of oneself and to persist in spite of all hardships, discouragements, and hindrances be genius. He made himself what he was, one of the noblest, greatest, and best of men, by sheer dint of hard work and the cultivation of the talents that had been given him. No fortunate chances, no influential friends, no rare opportunities played a part in his life. Alone and unaided, he made, by the grace of God, the great career which will forever challenge the admiration of mankind.